A single lost pound coin once felt like the end of the world. Growing up in East London, those gleaming towers of Canary Wharf were visible from the street, close enough to see, impossible to reach. Money wasn't just scarce, it shaped everything. Selling penny sweets, delivering newspapers, hustling for every coin. This was survival, not ambition. Years later, from the 42nd floor of Citibank, those childhood streets disappeared beneath a forest of glass and steel, invisible except in memory. What separated one kid from East London from the rest wasn't connections or wealth. It was an unusual gift for numbers and strategy. At the London School of Economics, surrounded by students who abandoned lectures to master financial jargon and network aggressively, the class divide felt insurmountable. But here's the thing about being an outsider. You see what insiders miss. Fresh eyes spot patterns that conventional thinking overlooks. When Citibank sponsored a trading card game competition, most students approached it with rigid calculations. The winning strategy? Understanding psychology, not just mathematics. Trading isn't really about numbers, it's about reading people. During that LSE competition, victory came from watching how players revealed their cards, exploiting their predictable logic, creating risk-free profits from human behavior. The fundamental truths emerged clearly. Individual traders can't dictate prices. Consensus determines value. And sometimes following successful strategies beats trying to outsmart everyone. The national final at Citigroup's headquarters revealed something deeper. Competitors excelled at calculations but couldn't adapt when conditions shifted. By manipulating price perceptions through confident, loud quotes, psychological warfare disguised as trading, the game changed. Then came the twist. The entire competition had been rigged to test resolve under extreme pressure. Success required not just strategic thinking, but persistence and boldness when everything felt designed to break you. The morning commute to Canary Wharf felt like entering another dimension. Inside Citigroup Center, beneath soaring architecture and expensive art, an employee had jumped from the balconies, testament to unbearable pressure. The fixed income trading floor, overwhelmed with endless monitors, constant noise, and frenetic energy. Survival required social savvy, nodding wisely during barely understood conversations, engaging personalities from meticulous Rupert to boisterous JB. Bill, though shorter than most, commanded respect through quiet confidence. When noise erupted, his silent gesture restored focus, a masterclass in subtle authority. Even fetching lunch became strategic, turning menial tasks into opportunities demonstrating reliability. The Sturt desk specialized in FX swaps, managing euros, pounds, and other currencies against the dollar. Running a currency book meant direct customer access and profit potential, but only for those making precise pricing decisions consistently. Newcomers began as cover traders, proving readiness when senior traders were away. Choosing a mentor shaped careers. Rupert Hobhouse embodied discipline, but used brutal training methods. Then came Theodore Spangler, eccentric, socially awkward, chaotic, yet his trading skills were undeniable. Through Spangler's patient tutoring, FX swaps finally clicked. Like pawning a gold watch for quick cash, an FX swap is essentially a secured currency exchange loan, establishing cross-currency flows essential to multinational operations. Brokers and traders occupy different worlds. Traders come from elite universities and take market risk. Brokers, typically from places like Essex without degrees, work as intermediaries, earning commissions that favor volume over quality. The initiation featured an extravagant Japanese lunch with Big Head's Cockney accent and Timothy Twynham's silver-tongued conversation amid excessive wine and exotic sashimi. These lunches became cultural exchanges, filled with humor and unrestrained antics. Late nights and heavy drinking were routine, with departures requiring permission, illustrating subtle power dynamics. Brokers showed remarkable adaptability, shifting from rowdy nightclub companions to restrained formal dinner guests. The 2008 financial crisis transformed everything, As Lehman Brothers collapsed, trading floors witnessed drastic changes and swift layoffs. Government bailouts prevented deeper collapse. Within trading circles, the crisis paradoxically created profitable opportunities. Traders exploited widened spreads and swaps as bank-to-bank lending dwindled, multiplying earnings while the broader economy struggled. Bill had foreseen this unraveling, betting against reckless lending long before disaster struck. His prescient wager on diverging interest rates generated millions just as market instability peaked. The trading floor mixed camaraderie with ruthless competition. When Spengler vanished, covering his trades exposed brutal politics. Trust no one or be exploited. Bonus day brought $13,000, significant but joyless. More meaningful was inheriting the Kiwi dollar book from JB, a token of respect despite its poor performance. When Caleb retired at 29 with enough wealth to never work again, his departure proved money trumped ambition. Over a farewell meal, an audacious goal emerged, a $100,000 bonus. Despite Caleb's laughter, a plan materialized, massive, barely executable trades scrawled on paper. Trading success revealed a troubling reality. While markets celebrated recovery, ordinary people struggled. Financial balance thrived on inequality, enriching the wealthy. Green euro dollars became the vehicle for betting against recovery. The insight was simple. Wealth disparities invalidated economic averages, creating mispriced opportunities. Markets wrongly anticipated rate hikes despite deepening inequality. Japan's earthquake demonstrated trading's chaos. Markets reacted inversely to catastrophe, benefiting positions predicting lower rates. Profiting from tragedy stirred ethical unease. Then Europe's sovereign debt crisis erupted. Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, shattering the illusion of risk-free banking. Trading success exacted steep personal costs. Dreams of Japan and Chile vanished as golden handcuffs tightened with each dollar earned. The trading floor transformed with unprecedented volumes, thrusting Citibank to the forefront. Harry spiraled into nightclubs and questionable company, while brokers exploited his vices, using him as a puppet to reach their real target. Amidst this chaos, a woman nicknamed Wizard became quiet resistance to the materialistic world. Her understanding and simplicity cut through the madness. Year-end stakes reached catastrophic levels, gnawing at sleep and sanity. When Harry invited strangers into their shared haven, confrontation erupted. Accusations flew, forcing both to ponder their ambitions and loyalties. Broken glass and pooled blood became tangible reminders of their detachment. Relocating to a stark flat brought self-imposed minimalism, a mattress, an old television, and haunting monotony. Wizard's gift of a red sofa offered small comfort, yet existential hollowness remained. A heated confrontation with a senior manager, nicknamed the Frog, over worn-out shoes, led to an unexpected resignation that left him stunned. Tokyo's towering skyscrapers and melancholic autumn atmosphere provided the perfect backdrop for contemplation, wandering through Marunouchi's blend of tradition and ambition. Arthur Kapofsky revealed the strategy behind recent success, betting on permanently low interest rates. A pivotal insight emerged. Inequality itself had become a tradable factor. Understanding this was essential for success, yet it raised uncomfortable questions about profiting from society's deepest fractures. 3 months of paid sick leave felt like emerging from confinement. Journeys to Kyushu and visits to Wizard's cramped apartment rediscovered warmth over tea and cozy meals. Legal consultations across three countries confirmed safety but advised caution. Returning to the Sturt desk felt absurd, caught between colleagues with nothing but Japanese textbooks to fill the time as Tokyo's surreal plum rains enveloped everything. A flurry of enigmatic emails to top management helped unravel the web. Liberation came unexpectedly. The last day arrived with understated farewells. Departing the trading floor lacked theatrical closure, but prompted reflection. The trader's uniform was shed amid Japan's oppressive heat, followed by a measured walk through the Imperial Gardens, questions about right and wrong circling. What does it mean to win? Walking away from millions, from status, from the identity that defined years, is that victory or surrender? Perhaps the real game was never about money. It was about recognizing when the cost of playing exceeds any possible reward. The towers of Canary Wharf still gleam in the distance, but now they're just buildings. The real wealth isn't measured in bonuses. It's in choosing to stop playing a game rigged against your humanity.